What happens if Robert Mueller subpoenas the president? Will you comply?
Well, we don't have to. He's the president of the United States.
Are you confident the president will not take the fifth in this case?
Oh, how could I ever be confident of that? When I'm facing a situation with the president and all the other lawyers are, in which every lawyer in America thinks he'd be a fool to testify, I've got a client who wants to testify. Please don't. He said it yesterday. And, you know, Jay and I said to ourselves, my goodness, I hope we get a chance to tell him the risks that he's taking.
I hope we get a chance to tell him the risk that he's taking. You're his lawyers. You have one job, literally. Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Reason Podcast, Editor's Roundtable Edition. I am Matt Welch, joined by three brainy editor colleagues stuffed in one tiny closet, maybe built for two people. Catherine Mangu-Ward, Peter Suderman, and Nick Gillespie. Catherine, can you tell what Nick had for breakfast?
No. Actually, I can because I saw him in the kitchen wolfing down pound cake right before
this.
It was
a pound cake shaped like a bundt cake, Matt. It was passing. Pound cake passing
and
as
that
a bundt
complies?
Cake.
No, it, of course
that
it doesn't.
That complies with whatever new fad diet.
Nick believes that kitchen food doesn't count in his diet.
I mean, I can eat anything as long as I don't cook it. That's the diet. But when I cook, I'm a strict vegan. It's not complicated.
Oh, God.
Before this completely goes off the rails, reminder to everyone listening, please subscribe to the Reason Podcast over there on iTunes and vomit a review while you're there. Today, we plan to get into the great subpoena debate, as teased at the top, some Iran deal skullduggery, discussion about snake people. And hopefully, if there's time for it, some general insults thrown in the direction of the Pacific Northwest. But first, you were listening there at the top, obviously, hopefully, to President Trump's defense lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, talking on Sunday with George Stephanopoulos about what is likely to be the big legal debate showdown over the next few months. And that is whether special counsel Robert Mueller will subpoena President Trump to testify in the Russia investigation. Whether Trump will refuse, comply, or plead the fifth, whether this will all end up at the Supreme Court, how the court would then rule, whether Trump would comply, and a veritable smorgasbord of conditionals, which people are already trying to cook up the phrase constitutional crisis to describe it. So let's sort of start at the beginning of this entire chain with Catherine. Should special counsel Robert Mueller, in your estimation, Catherine Mangu-Ward, issue a subpoena? He apparently told the Trump defense team that he's considering issuing a subpoena for President Trump to testify back in March. And obviously, there's some kind of negotiating dance going on right here. But is it a proper thing for him to do? Should he go through with it?
I think the president is a citizen and citizens are subject to subpoenas. Now, having been subpoenaed collectively, I think we can all agree that it's not a pleasant experience. And having been subpoenaed and gagged, doubly so. At the same time, I don't think we should stand on presidential privilege here. Of course, the other part of that question is, should Trump talk when subpoenaed? And as the immortal Ken White has said on our website, Donald Trump shouldn't talk to the feds, and neither should you.
It seems clear that Rudy Giuliani agrees with you vociferously there, Catherine. Nick, one thing that Giuliani said over the weekend was that if he actually talks to investigators, it could lead to a Martha Stewart style situation in which you're kind of rung up based on your answers to questions rather than anything to do with an underlying crime. And kind of given that James Comey in his book was like, hell yeah, you see what we did to Martha Stewart? That's great. Does Giuliani kind of have a point there?
Yeah, totally. I mean, there's no reason for anybody to testify unless you're absolutely forced to. Because the way the FBI works, and it's not even testifying in court or anything, it's when you make incorrect statements or anything like that. I mean, this one of the things that strikes me as worrisome about the whole Russia investigation or the Mueller investigation is, every time you talk to these people, you're setting yourself up for some kind of obstruction of justice. And Martha Stewart was not found guilty of insider trading, as popular kind of wisdom has it. It was, obstruction of justice or making misstatements to law enforcement. So in that sense, you know, I think Trump would be wise not to testify or to plead the fifth. Nothing good is coming out of that. One of the things that is an interesting kind of ancillary story about this whole case is now people on the left are saying broadly, or critics of Donald Trump more accurately, are saying, you know, anybody who pleads the fifth is admitting guilt. And, you know, 5 years ago, if it was Republicans who would say anybody who pleads the fifth in a federal investigation is obviously guilty. And if nothing else, maybe we'll come out of this understanding that pleading the fifth is not an indication of guilt. And that's a good thing.
Peter, let's actually follow up on that, since you write for Vox, besides saying that it's sort of a tantamount to admitting at least part of your guilt, people are saying that it would be some kind of political disaster if Trump pled the fifth. Do you agree with any sense of that?
Well, I totally agree with Nick that pleading the fifth is not an indicator of guilt, and that we should not treat it as one culturally, politically, etc. I do think it would be a big political problem for Trump. I just don't think that there's any way to avoid that. People would look at that and think, and they would ask, what is he hiding? And they
would look at that.
But I think also the general public Trump is not a super popular president. Trump is not someone who has an awful lot of trust. And in fact, this entire instance, like this whole sort of drawn out story, what it has shown us is that the Trump apparatus, and so I'm talking about Donald Trump himself, but also all of the people who claim at times to speak for him, just can't be trusted on anything at all. Not on big picture policy stuff, but not on tiny personal.
They will lie about what he had for breakfast. I mean, they will. It's really frustrating.
This is not a new thing with Trump. Trump did this constantly on the campaign trail, but now he has spread it to his apparatchiks and to the people who represent him, from Rudy Giuliani to Sarah Huckabee Sanders to Kellyanne Conway, and Sean Hannity, sure, who is effectively a spokesperson for Donald Trump at this point, and in fact
let's
not talk about all the rest of us here, all of these people who are windows into Trump's thinking when we're not looking at his Twitter feed. And so given that we have very good reason, I think, to not trust Trump and his team on anything, if he did decide to go in and take the fifth, it would be, first of all, novel and unprecedented for a president to do this. And second of all, it would sort of affirm the image of President Trump as being someone who has a lot to hide, who is probably lying about a lot, not who is probably, who we know now at this point. There is no way to square all of the stories that he and his people have told and say that there is not a lie in here. And so there is a bunch of lying that has happened. And so if he took the fifth,
right,
that would simply cement that image further. Again, I also think that it would be a mistake, certainly for anyone at this table, if we're in the media, to say, well, he took the fifth, guy's guilty.
That's not the way
to think about this.
I think Mueller would be really slow to actually subpoena him, because that does create the grounds for a constitutional crisis of some sort of confrontation.
I think Mueller doesn't want to.
Yeah.
And Mueller doesn't want to because we don't want to get into that sort of constitutionally unique territory. We don't want to. That is not a test of the Constitution and of executive privilege and court privilege that we want to have. And so I think Mueller is aware of this, as is Trump's legal team, and they would all probably prefer not to have a subpoena. It is, I think, something that we shouldn't say definitely shouldn't happen, but we shouldn't be rooting for that to happen.
I want to point out that one of Trump, and I haven't heard him claim this as a success, but turning Rudy Giuliani into the way Giuliani sounds now, he's like a Wild West, like an Old West prospector who's still mining for gold somewhere in the middle of Nevada. It's kind of an amazing diminution from America's mayor to being able to speak in full sentences and to actually sound like he's from the East Coast. And now he's kind of like, you know, this is the Lord's house. And it's like, oh, you know where? I mean, he's like Yukon Cornelius or something from.
Well, everybody who joins the Trump team at this point in the game is aware that doing so almost always sullies your reputation. And so the only people that are joining are people who have no reputation, who think that basically any amount of kind of press.
So R. Kelly is going to be singing the national anthem.
I actually think also that clip that we just heard from Giuliani is a great example of him learning from this thing that Trump is really good at, where he leaves the ends of his sentences unspoken as insurance against negative interpretation.
He just keeps starting, and then
But if you really think about, you know what I'm saying.
You guys are all talking like my dad right now.
Yeah, but this is. I actually think
he's a master persuader.
Whether it's conscious or whether it's intuitive, but I think, you know, when you look at, particularly during the campaign, all of these scandals of like, oh, Trump told Megyn Kelly she had her period, so she was dumb or whatever. When you look at the actual sentence, he never quite says the thing, which gave him plausible deniability. And a lot of people sort of bought his version of whatever the quote was and said, no, look, if you look, I didn't quite say those words. And I think what we just heard Giuliani do was sort of something similar there. He was like, well, I would, oh, goodness, it seems we would urge him.
It's true that Trump's inability to speak in complete sentences is then deployed for strategic advantage by both Trump and even more so by the people who represent him.
Henry
II, where he's like, well, somebody rid me of this turbulent priest. You know, he's just issuing vague
but
orders.
I wish that you guys could see the hand gestures that Nick is accompanying his.
It's like
Giuliani, it would end up being like, turbulent priest. I don't know. Gotta just.
Yeah. That'd be great. Bring in a lot of jobs back.
Catherine, you said first that all presidents should be subject to the law. But you also referenced our unpleasantness at the hands of Preet Bharara. And we were also talking about Martha Stewart. So kind of combining all of that. Does it bother you? I'm someone who's kind of in favor of the Mueller investigation writ large. I'm glad that it exists, and I think it's proper for it to exist. I'm also haunted by, what if he's just rolling all of the C-team randos around Trump? Because obviously they're liars with sketchy pasts, and you can get them to flip because they've got something on themselves and they lie to federal prosecutors, and you just keep rolling and rolling and flipping and flipping. And at the end, you just got a New York bullshitter, and you're going to get him on New York bullshitting. Does that concern you as like a possible kind of outcome or thing that we're dealing
with? Yeah, it definitely concerns me just in a kind of macro way. I also think it's related to this thing we were just talking about with people who plead the fifth, right? Like, it's, you know, it is not evidence of guilt when you plead the fifth. It's not evidence of guilt when you use extra encryption on your email. It's not evidence of guilt when you use a Tor browser. It's evidence of a pretty, you know, cynical, yet I would argue accurate understanding of the way that the law will distort your words to string you up for whatever they can get you on once they come after you. And this is something that Ken White says in his piece for us. He says, this is not an inquiry in search of the truth, or it's certainly not only that. Once you get to the point where you've been subpoenaed by Mueller, they're just looking for something to get you on. And that's what happened with Martha Stewart. And that's what happens with ordinary people all the time. Once you're under the lens, it's always easy to find something that you've done wrong.
I was about to ask Nick, what are they going to find with you when they've done wrong? But I realized
I don't want to ask that question. There isn't enough memory space, storage space online for that, man. Next question. I'll take the fifth on that one.
But you invoked the possibility of a constitutional crisis, Nick. Any kind of a pie in the skying of what is your best guess about what one of those under Trump might look like, if you had to imagine the worst case
scenario? Yeah, I think it would be a kind of slow moving, you know, kind of iceberg floating down from the Arctic, until it kind of melts away. But I think it would be a standoff, and it would be less of a crisis and more of a confrontation. And I do think, you know, there's reasons why the president might say, like, fuck you. You know, you're investigating me. It's my Justice Department investigating me, but it is an out of control investigation that is just trying to destroy the executive branch. And, you know, and it's redolent of deep state paranoia and all of that kind of stuff. But I think you would see a standoff and then it would just kind of linger on. I am very highly convinced that Trump is not going to run for reelection. I think he's already hit basically all of his high points and he knows when to leave. And I think he's, you know, and he'll stall until, you know, until he's out of office. But I do think it will paralyze things even more.
That's one of those predictions that's a great political, like a pundit prediction to make, because on the off chance that you're right, everyone will be like, wow, yeah. Remember when Nick said Trump wasn't going to run? And yeah. on the much
Why
more likely chance that you're
again?
Wrong, no one will remember.
I've looked at all the angles and it just doesn't make
because
sense.
Because people always run. People yeah. never don't run.
I don't know, James
When you're
Polk,
already the president, you want to keep being the president.
But also
Polk
because the Republican
a clear
Party.
Example.
You're just dropping some James,
James
Polk
Knox
on
Polk.
Me here.
You know, he
okay.
did.
But, yeah,
but
don't,
also
don't ever say James Polk without the K.
The Republican
Never
Party has
K.
now organized itself almost entirely around a defense of the Trump persona.
Which may totally change depending on the midterms. Like if they take a shellacking in the midterms, they're going to be like, okay, we got to come
sure,
up with
Sure, it's possible, but they're doing it even as Trump is quite unpopular already because Trump is actually becoming more popular amongst the Republican base. And so if you are
and
a
people
Republican
in general, his approval ratings are
trying to generate enthusiasm amongst Republican voters, sticking by Trump is the way to do that. And so I think it's quite unlikely that he retires unless one of these scandals ends up increasing in size and scale. Yeah,
so here I'm going to make it easy.
Taking the retirement out.
I bet you $100, $100 in fiat currency
there you
of
go,
your
Mitt
choosing.
Romney. Bring
of
it
your
on.
Choosing, yeah. And a hot dog dinner, a gourmet hot dog dinner, that Trump does not run for reelection.
I don't bet cash. I only bet bottles of liquor.
Okay.
Catherine, before we
foiled.
Pivot out
yes.
of here.
You know, cash is fungible, what? Peter. You can use it to buy anything.
Yeah, but you can drink scotch.
Wouldn't the word fungible be more fun if the G was hard? Fungible?
That would sound like it would. It could that. Die and get fungus on it.
Yeah, I don't know.
Fungible, it seems like a mushroom right. that you would buy at Whole Foods and then not really know what to do with.
And then chop it up and put it in pasta and wish you hadn't paid $30 for mushrooms.
Jimmy Reese hit fungos to the warning track.
Yeah, this no, sounds like you have some experience.
Yeah, Funjoes would be terrible. I mean, baseball would not be America's pastime if it was Funjoes. So.
Okay, ask me your question.
In defense
Matt,
of
save
the hard
from this conversation that you started.
Just putting the fun back
Mark.
In fungible.
get Peter out of the room, please. No, just the Freedom Caucus. I can't even talk about it. It gets me kind of a little ticked. But the Mark Meadows and Jim Jeffords of the world, the chairman and co-founder, or actually founder, respectively, of the Freedom Caucus, they're out there now talking about impeachment, not of of President Trump, obviously, but of Rod Rosenstein and Jeff Sessions and God knows who else.
I think
else,
they're actually trying to impeach Hillary Clinton.
Else.
Isn't that really what they're...
Well, it's a, you know, once they wrap up Benghazi, they're going to turn their full attention
up.
To... you know, to whatever's going on now.
What can we say about what was supposed to be the most kind of libertarian, most constitutionally oversightnal, and that was a great
whatever.
Adjective, group there engaged in such activities and talking in terms of witch hunts?
I, in general, when people shout witch hunt, I assume that they're witches. So I guess that's a good place to start here. No, I mean, I think the hope that the Freedom Caucus would be a check on the rising populism in the Republican Party
but
has
they're not.
Turned out to be a lost hope. Yeah. It
so
didn't
they're
work
useless.
At all.
They're useless.
It's good to still say the words. It's good to do the kabuki theater. It's good to, you know, keep the flame burning, but they're
the
not.
Flame of witchcraft burning and
yes,
the Salem
it all
hearth
sounds
at the
extremely
House of the Seven
occult
Gables.
When you yeah. say it like that. No, I mean, I continue to be happy that these guys exist. I do think, however, that they have lost the thread a little bit, and more importantly, even if they were all totally on point and maximizing their impact on the Hill every single day in favor of libertarian principles and constitutional defense, they still just couldn't make much of a dent. Like, they are a small group against a very powerful tide of anti-constitutionalist populism.
I will be more forthright. I think the Freedom Caucus is useless, and the only caucus I want to talk about anymore is a Libertarian Caucus, which I realize would have like a half a member on a given day. But like, I want a Libertarian Caucus. If the Republican Party, and
if we had a Libertarian Caucus, we could maybe call it like the Freedom Caucus, and it would be these guys. Like, I don't know what you want.
The Libertarian Caucus, like, where we're going to reduce the size, scope, and spending of government. We're going to stop talking about bullshit culture war stuff that only expands the size, scope, and spending of government. We're going to, rethink and reframe American foreign policy. We're going to fucking cut spending year over year. And we're going to cut taxes, yes, but we're going to cut spending by even more. I mean, like,
all these dudes say that.
They don't
and sometimes
say
they
that.
Don't
They're like,
vote
oh,
that
except
way.
For, oh, we're going to cut spending by cutting, the 30 cents
that Planned
Parenthood
gets. But your imaginary Libertarian Caucus wouldn't
Yeah, but I, that's all I want. I don't care. Like, I'm sick of people who are like, I'm a limited government person, but, what we have to do is pass a constitutional amendment against abortion, and we're not going to talk about drugs or criminal justice reform. It's like, fuck you. You've had 50 years of that. Can we just start getting to libertarian principles of saying we spent $4 trillion last year, this year we're spending 3.8, in 2 years we're spending 3.5,
I don't think we're going to get there without some sort of leadership. And this to me has always been the danger of Trump, is that it blesses and encourages the worst instincts inside Congress. Trump is
You don't think
always
Cocaine
been,
Mitch, if he gets... snorts enough.
I'm very excited to see him as the villain in Scarface 2. But
that will be the most boring
say hello
version.
My little friend.
He will be animated as a turtle, as he should be. No, is that presidents and party leaders serve an organizing function, and parties basically end up. It's not that they just sort of end up doing exactly what their president, what their sort of most senior figure tells them to do, but those are the people who end up determining to a large extent what a party's priorities are at any given moment. And right now, the Republican Party has no legislative agenda of any kind. They don't even have one that's kind of bad. They just have none. And that's in some ways better than having a very bad one. But what they have done, their entire agenda is simply a defense of Trump and of Trump as a cultural figure. And so Trump has become the gay wedding cake of 2018 that everybody has to fight about. And the cake itself never mattered. I mean, yes, it did matter specifically, but the cake was always a sort of an autonomy for a larger issue. And that's what Trump is. Are you for him? Are you against
him?
What
kind of cake is Donald Trump? On the inside. We know what the frosting looks like. I mean, it's kind of an orange, an orange-scented
The issue of Reason magazine lemon. From 2 months ago that had a Donald Trump cake on the cover as an indication, we filled it with with an orange blossom buttercream from this Brooklyn bakery that Joanna Andreessen ordered it from. So there you go.
All right. I trust our editor-in-chief
and our
art director to
an extremely white
kind of
cake, an alternative, an alt-white
but
cake.
But vanilla cake, let's vanilla, be clear. Yeah.
I think it's
so. Speaking of Congress's abdication of duties, segue. Yeah. The Iran nuclear deal is up for tossing in the garbage as of May 12th. Rudy Giuliani, our hero from the first segment, also gave a speech Saturday at the Iran Freedom Convention for Democracy and Human Rights in Washington. At which he said that President Trump is, quote, as committed to regime change as we are. Unquote. He said that the regime change is the only way to peace in the Middle East. And then later in the speech, for theatrical effect, Giuliani pretended that his speech notes were the Iran nuclear deal and then ripped them up and then spat on them.
I'm thinking that Rudy should have paid the extra $60 on 23andMe to get the medical test about early onset Alzheimer's.
Oh, my God. Let's kind of just start with the first principles here. Again, Catherine, you're the first principles in chief person. Is regime change in Iran the only way to peace in the Middle East?
It's not a way that's available. Like, I guess that's the main thing, is even if it were the only way to peace in the Middle East, it is not a way that we can get to from where we are. It's probably also just fundamentally not a good idea to be in the business of regime change all over the world, since that's not worked out very well. Today, I think, maybe yesterday on Fox and Friends, we had Boris Johnson as the voice of reason. Like, they like put crazy, crazy Boris Johnson on Fox and Friends to speak directly to the president and ask him not to throw the baby out with the bathwater and to just kind of keep this semi-functional status quo ticking along. When you're, you know, you can sort of imagine the thought process that went into that. Like, who? Okay, we got to put someone on Fox and Friends because that's the only thing Trump listens to. Who will he identify with? Who will he look at and be like, this guy gets it? And they're like, Boris Johnson, this is going to be perfect. I assume that's what happened there. No, I don't know. I mean, you know, the Iran deal is complicated. I think the correct answer depends hugely on whose empirical case you believe about whether the status quo is better than it was a year ago, right? Like, that matters a lot. And I don't feel like I have a good way to adjudicate that. I feel like a lot of Americans don't. Donald Trump definitely doesn't.
What does Fox and Friends say? I'm sure they've got
I mean, they booked Boris Johnson. Right. So I think that tells us what they think is they.
Brian Kilmeade in that spot was great. As Fox and Friends host. He's like, well, why didn't you make a better deal, Boris Johnson? Huh? Why wasn't the Iran deal any better? It's your fault. And Boris Johnson was like, we weren't in power. Then.
And also, like, I was somewhere like drunk under a table. Like, I mean, it's like none of this is
my finger was in an electrical outlet, hence my haircut.
But yeah, I think, you know, in general with foreign policy, I don't know how to describe my foreign policy principles, but I would say it's something like muddle through and try to make it a teeny bit better without causing nuclear war, which is my way of saying probably don't.
I believe that is, in fact, the libertarian position.
Yeah. I mean, why? I'm part of my own gestalt.
You're against nuclear war? Why not?
That's the other libertarian position, just contrarian assholery.
Now, here's my bet. And again, I'm ready to bet with Peter now, knowing that he will never take a bet unless I'm like, I have a flagon of, you know, mead that I'll bet you, sir.
I don't drink mead.
Oh, Peter, right, so, you just made it much worse.
No,
if
but
accepted this, the mead
they're
bet,
not,
you could have redeemed yourself.
You know, it's a May 12th deadline, right? That's going to come and go, and there's going to be a bunch of hemming and hawing. We're not going to pull out of the nuclear deal or the Iran deal.
Ooh.
No, absolutely
Nick is like,
not.
He is.
No, because this is. Think about what
Cassandra-ing
Trump.
Cassandra-ing it up here.
No, it's a reverse Cassandra. It's not as bad as we say.
Everyone believes you and
it's
you're
like,
wrong.
Cassandra,
that's what a reverse Cassandra
did,
is.
She put on a big robe or something? I don't know. What's the opposite of a robe? You know?
Does she have a robe? I don't know.
Yeah,
I just thought the
snuggie.
Whole point
a robe?
Of her.
Yeah, a snuggie.
The snuggie of all seeing futurism.
I'm just kind of combining reverse Cassandra with Stormy Daniels, and my brain is just.
Oh, yeah. No, that was one of her finest movies, the reverse Cassandra. it's like with the tariffs and stuff like that. There's going to be a lot of hemming and hawing or DACA and all that. We're not going to get any action on May 12th, and he's not going to pull out of the Iran deal because the Iran deal is actually working, and I think everybody knows that. He will cut a deal with, you know, Israel will be satisfied in some kind of way and stuff like that, but he's not pulling out of the Iran deal.
Wow.
Take
so
to
pursuant
the bank.
To that,
put a lock
Peter,
on it. That's my lock of the week, Matt.
Take Nick's bet or address Nick's bet, Peter. And then also, if you can, since you live in Washington, do you have any sense of what a plan B is? That's what I don't get in all the Trump belligerence towards the Iran nuclear deal, which he keeps, you know, reasserting. And he's surrounded himself now in the personae of Mike Pompeo, Secretary of State, and John Bolton as his national security advisor, with people who, unlike their predecessors, are also hostile to the existing Iran nuclear deal. So what's the plan B, and what are you going to extract from Nick when he loses?
So I think if Nick is wrong, it will be because of what you just said, which is that Trump has surrounded himself with Iran hawks, and Pompeo in particular, but also Bolton, and also Mike Pence. These are folks who really have argued that the Iran deal is so bad that we shouldn't be in it, that we should back out. And they never say what plan B is. Now, in theory, it could be just to renegotiate it, perhaps even to renegotiate effectively the exact same deal with a couple of small tweaks. I mean, it could be, you know, the Iran plan B could basically be the Republican Obamacare replacement, which is just like Obamacare, but with some different shit.
But with higher premiums.
Right. Yeah. Right. But worse and shittier for everyone. And so that's one possibility. But I also think that pulling out of the deal, if they did it in a strong way, in a really aggressive way, would be a step towards attacks. And that's not something that they want to come out and say that's where we're headed, but that is the implication from a lot of these hawks, is that maybe we don't want to get into a full-scale war, but that we do want to start dropping bombs on Iran's weapons facilities and basically just destroying nuclear and weapons facilities there in Iran, which would, of course, they would say, well, they would probably say, this is not a war that we're getting into. These are targeted strikes. But you can't make that determination up front when you start dropping bombs on another country. It's very difficult to say, well, this is, you know, as I've said, I think before on this podcast, you can't throw the first punch in a bar fight and be like, oh, no, wait, now it's over. Sometimes you can, I suppose, but
if you knock them out.
Yeah, I was going to say, it depends how hard you punch, my friend.
No, right. And this is why there's no, like, John Bolton may be a hawk, but he's not an idiot. And there's no way, like, if you're going to do that, it's got to be like part, then they're planning some kind of major engagement in the Middle East that would include bombing Syria, fortifying troops in Iraq, talking with Turkey. I think
it's less likely. I would bet against the very aggressive scenario if I had to bet, but I would also try to avoid betting. And here's why, is because, you know, let's take this back to the point that we were discussing a little earlier, the total lack of a Republican agenda. What is the one thing that Republicans haven't done under Trump that really unifies the Republican Party is bomb countries in the Middle East. I mean, that is a thing that, like, when Republican presidents do that, Republican voters think that's pretty awesome. And so if they are looking for a kind of an organizing, a rallying point, a war or a kind of low-level quasi-war with Iran, this strikes me as the sort of thing that, just from a political perspective, they might say, well, this is one of our goals anyway. You know, it's not like we've launched a whole bunch of other wars so far. We've been relatively restrained. Let's basically start a war in Iran, and that will be our platform going into 2020, and then we'll be able to paint Democrats as, you know, as chickens, as doves, who are just like, they're not sufficiently pro-American, they're not sufficiently patriotic, you know, the whole sort of George W. playbush, you're against the war, you're undermining American troops, etc. And so that strikes me as both a kind of policy and political outcome that they might settle on. And Trump himself is not, I think, as we've talked about, you know, a sort of super hawk, but he's somebody who appreciates the kind of manly, macho assertiveness of striking big and of hitting somebody hard, and doesn't think super sophisticated way about all of this stuff. So since he has surrounded himself with Pence, with Bolton, and now with Pompeo at state, and Pompeo really is a pretty serious hawk who will now have a fair amount of influence in this realm, it does strike me as at least a possibility that we should recognize as real, that this could end up being the Trump administration's political plan for 2020, as well as their main policy goal.
And, you know, just to add, pour a little lighter fluid on that, Peter, you know, Matt, I think you agree that foreign policy in America is often dictated by domestic policy. You know, here, if Trump gets into big trouble over Mueller or, you know, various things at home, I could see that possibly being a play. My best guess, and, you know, this, I'm making it up, but I think Trump is going to, like, make some kind of token gesture that where it's like, I'm about to pull out. I'm really going to pull out if you don't. And he's going to try and weasel, get a little bit of, Catherine is laughing at that.
I'm so sorry to
conjure up bad, you know, your college years.
Yeah, just risk-cassandering this whole thing.
But he's going to come up with some minor adjustment, and then he's going to be like, "And see what I did? I just made this goddamn shitty deal the greatest deal in the world." Like, that's what he's doing with trade. That's what he's doing with a bunch of stuff.
I think a token action is the most likely outcome here, but I just wouldn't rule out the possibility of something much more aggressive.
I'm also, by the way, my other lock of a prediction is that by this time next week, Colin Kaepernick will probably be Secretary of State. I think Pompeo is on the way out.
And okay, by so the way, Nick has completely
okay,
taken
by the way, Matt, I'm going to take the dollars bet on that one.
Yeah, I think I'm looking across the table at Catherine and Peter, and they have no idea who Colin Kaepernick is.
Next month's expense report. Totally.
We totally do, but only because of politics, not because of sports.
I think that Nick has probably been hitting Mike Riggs's microdose stash over there in that drawer. And that's a good thing. A man should be experimenting.
A man should exceed his limitations. Didn't Dirty Harry say that?
Just to be clear, there are no drugs in the Reason office.
No
drugs.
That
was entirely.
You put them out and they're gone in like 5 seconds.
Yeah, I was going to say.
You think that blueberry pound cake went fast? You should have seen the pot brownies.
Like, the number of people that have posted in the last week about the fact that their boss made them pot brownies is probably going to put the lie there.
Speaking of millennials, Catherine, there was a great piece by our resident. Is Elizabeth Noel Brown, she's a millennial, right? She's a late term millennial?
She feels strongly that she is. We'll leave it at that.
She's a zennial with an X.
How can you say she's that? Isn't she? She's like 29, something like that. She's millennial.
Definitely not 29.
Oh, she's lying about her age.
To who? Liz is a millennial. Yep, yeah. Sure.
Anyways, she pointed last week to a gigantor, a new national poll from Reuters Ipsos, I believe, of young voters, and it contained the startling-ish news that since 2016, since Trump has been elected, millennials' stated preference for Democrats has not increased. It's actually decreased by 9 percentage points. It's crazy, to 46% overall. And in fact, young white men in particular have completely flipped. They favored Democrats 48-36 back in 2016, and now they favor Republicans to Democrats 46-37. A lot of possible different takeaways from
thank
this,
you, Pajama
poll,
Boy,
which was yes, thank you, Pajama Boy.
I thought you were calling
extra,
Matt Pajama Boy
step.
For a minute there. I was like, that seems unfair.
Yeah. No, I've got dad shorts on over here, so let's be clear about that. Catherine, takeaways from that. Is this are millennials just more untethered than before? What you're millennial adjacent. What were your kind of broad takeaways from that?
You know, this is the one place where y'all have won me over with your repeated hawking of your Declaration of Independence book is I really do
we wrote a book.
You wrote a book. Wow. Yeah. And Matt wrote his part in Prague and then in Brooklyn, and you wrote your part in New Jersey.
And Ohio,
it was a great book.
And a toxic
and
dump.
The part where you just say, like, listen, people don't want to affiliate with parties and this is good. Like, that is like a very simple point. You're obviously right about it. To the extent that people are looking at different demographic slices, it seems to be, you know, it seems to be true here about these millennial folk. I think in his the NRA speech last week, Trump directly thanked Kanye West for the fact that his numbers with blacks improved this week.
They doubled.
But then he was like, they doubled from 11 to 22. And it was like, don't tell people you were at freaking 11% with a major part of the American public before. I mean, not that it's a surprise, I guess, but yeah, in general, I think a world in which people say fuck you to both parties is good, and a world in which people slip back and forth easily is also good. That we want people's loyalties to be fickle when it comes to partisan affiliation.
Nick, I want to give you a chance to talk about a book that you co-wrote in 2011. The thing that strikes me about this, that it reminds me of a thing that we were actually writing about at the time, which is that in response to Obama, yes, the 2010 midterms went Republican, as midterms usually do in the first term of a presidency. but actual public affection and membership to the Republican Party during this, that was a pretty tumultuous time, didn't increase.
No, and earlier, there was the Reuters-Ipsos poll that Liz was writing about, and a couple weeks before that, there was a Harvard Institute of Politics study that found that Republicans are losing millennials. And, you know, this goes from the point, one thing that's interesting is if you go back to 2000, basically George Bush and Al Gore split almost every demographic. Not surprising. I mean, the election came down to a few hundred votes, really. But Bush was pretty good among millennials and younger voters. And since then, the Republican Party has just died among young people. Who can blame them? I mean, they are the party. I mean, this is a party that most recently supported a freaking child molester, like a Bible thumping child molester from Alabama. That doesn't play well with younger people, because they
seniors,
could be,
on the other hand, are just
seniors
like,
don't
you know,
care.
Once you're no, once you're 65, yeah, it's like the kitty touching. That's what everybody does.
They mistook them for their grandchildren or his grandchildren or something.
You
but like,
think
it
I
is
kind
like,
of
no, it's it.
I,
the
I
Republican
kind of disagree
Party
with the child molesters are. Liked less by millennials thesis, but all right.
Well, you know, if you have data, lay it on the table. But no, all I'm saying
is bit of data
The Republican Party has spent the past 15 years at least absolutely going out of its way to repel younger voters. They
I
are
totally
anti-gay. You know, they're anti-gay or dragging their feet. They're anti-immigrant. They're anti-pot legalization. They're pro-war. They're pro-defense spending. They are terrible. They're bad on privacy issues for the most part. They're supporting mass surveillance. Now, what's interesting, of course, is not that the Republicans suck with young people, because the Republicans increasingly suck with all parts of America. It's that the Democrats are rightly losing millennials. And there was the Obama effect. Obama was young and he was exciting and hopeful and idealistic. That is wearing off because, you know, when you go to bed with Obama and you wake up with people like Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton and Elizabeth Warren, and it's kind of like you wake up with a corpse. I mean, these are people who are dead and so rooted in the past. Democrats realize that, you know, this party doesn't give a shit about them or their future. The Democrats, like the Republicans, see young people as a way to pay for old age entitlements and to maintain a kind of welfare warfare state that ultimately is not going to help them at all. So more power to the youngs.
Peter, one thing that stuck out to a lot of people looking at this poll, and I referenced it before, is that Republicans gained most significantly within the millennial camp among young white males. And so the sarcastic in me wants to ask, do you have any theories about that? And then the someone who spends too much time with Camille Foster in me wants to ask, are we being too easy to jump to the obvious conclusion about that?
I don't know if I want to say it's that you shouldn't jump to the obvious conclusion, but the gain amongst Republicans there is small enough that I wouldn't place too much emphasis on it. And I guess I think that if you look at millennials and you poll them on their beliefs and why they sort of attach to one party or another, or why they gravitate towards certain political figures or others, it's almost always because of cultural and social issues. And the Republic, and so if you came coming out of the 2012 election, for example, what polls of millennials, young voters, really showed that basically it was all about gay marriage and immigrants, and to a lesser extent, abortion. Millennial views on abortion are somewhat complicated. And if you listen to Nick talking about millennials there just a little bit ago, what were the sorts of things he was talking about? He talked about gay marriage and immigration, also pot legalization, privacy issues, all of these sorts of they're not non-policy issues. They're meaningful. Like, these are substantive issues. And so I don't want to please don't get confused and think that I'm trying to dismiss them. But they're not sort of core economic kind of budget spending regulation issues. And when you poll millennials on those things, they have in some cases they come across as quite socialist. And in other cases, they come across as really quite willing to basically let the market fulfill their needs because that's what they're used to. And so my sense of this, and I don't think I have a sort of full poll to back all of this up, but my sort of basic thesis on this is that millennials have very quite strongly held cultural beliefs and fairly weakly held beliefs about economic policy, which leads them on the one hand to be more open to a kind of socialist outlook, but on the other hand presents an opening for kind of a libertarian synthesis of these things as well, simply because millennials, young people, are so much more used to than their peers the kind of a market competition providing all sorts of services that just didn't exist 10, 15, 20 years ago. That's the world they've grown up in. And so while they're probably not going to get super on board with an extremely limited, you know, sort of let's really cut the government down to size, a kind of basic libertarian synthesis strikes me of, you know, sort of open on social issues and willing to let market actors be the kind of front lines for providing the services that we need for to connect ourselves and to make our economy happen. Strikes me as kind of where millennials are at. And so in some ways, you know, that kind of explains the, on the one hand, like they're super into tech and leaving things unregulated and just sort of not having privacy sort of in the traditional sort of sense. And on the other hand, being like, yeah, I don't know, this whole Bernie Sanders thing, jobs guarantee, single payer also sounds kind of OK. But then when you look, you get them sort of to talk about the details, there's just not a lot there. And so, you know, I think maybe what I'm saying is the battle for like the libertarian soul of millennials is still being fought. And it's going to be fought between two sort of sets of ideas that aren't that have not been like the main sets of ideas in the Republican and Democratic parties over the last 50 years, which is sort of the mommy party and the daddy party, you know, sort of the strong social programs and dovishness.
So we want to be provide the anti-MAME option where we're just like the fun, adventurous,
I think we're the much older teenage sister.
I don't know. I feel I've always felt like
do you know
the
MAME? Do you know the
cool
musical MAME?
Yeah. Anti-MAME is ultimately not
the cool uncle, kind of, right? Like,
well, a cool uncle
I think
is,
we all just,
in a post-Roy Moore world.
Just revealing who we identify with.
I said cool aunt first.
Yeah.
Because I've got a
and
cool aunt.
And he said anti-MAME.
I'm thinking about,
you know.
I'm thinking about Steve Martin and Uncle Todd who waves his
not
penis.
Not that kind of uncle.
But maybe that's
please.
Not where...
That wasn't
Matt,
what I was thinking
Matt,
at all.
Yeah, you said that out loud,
uncle
Matt.
Is different.
Yeah, no.
actually, this is all Peter's soliloquy is a fine transition into where this battle is kind of happening in real time, which is the increasingly ridiculous city of Seattle, which next
the
week...
The Emerald City,
is,
right?
The Emerald City is scheduled to vote on an employee head tax, which is just as batshit as it sounds. It would impose a 26-cent levy on every hour worked by an employee at companies that make more than $20 million a year. Obviously, this is known locally as the Amazon tax. Obviously, or at least logically, Amazon has said, you know what, we're not going to keep expanding here, that we had this planned expansion. We're not going to do it until we find out how this insane vote gets done. This is just one in a long line of pretty crazy things that Seattle has been doing. The council member there, Kashama Sawant, who's a self-proclaimed socialist, led a protest against Amazon because Amazon reacted to this in the obvious way. They've got like bike lanes that were supposed to cost X, and it cost 14 times X. They're in streetcars.
I don't understand how bike lanes can be so expensive. It's paint, right? It's just paint.
You're thinking
occasionally
small.
Like I ride bikes in bike lanes sometimes. It's paint.
You're a monster. Second of all, you don't understand how difficult it is to paint things.
I do not understand how difficult it is to paint things.
Opening line from Johnny Lydon's Public Image Limited Pill Seattle song? Don't like the look of this old town. What goes up must come down. Character is lost and found on unfamiliar playing ground. That's what I think of Seattle, Matt. And I want to know, how did they come up with the 26 cents?
I'm going to assume
maybe it's a kind of
Illuminati.
A quarter plus
Where's
one?
The worksheet on that?
Code,
you know?
Yeah. The Cokes chose that number?
Yeah, maybe that's like the Cokes' favorite number. So we're going to stick it to them.
Yeah.
Does this provide... I mean, we see stuff like this happening all the time. Los Angeles, San Francisco, Portland, all of the new kind of economic regulation type of stuff that comes out of those cities, most are crazy. I mean, like, not even, they just are unrecognizably almost crazy.
You were
crazy.
About
is
to go
possible?
Full CeeLo Green there, weren't you, Matt?
I can if necessary. Although I think I have a capo on that guitar, so it'll be difficult. But is it possible that we will finally start to see, just to thread this with the previous topic, people like the young tech people who work in these cities to say, you know what? Come on. I'm a little bit socialist, but come on, never go full socialist.
I think this is something that we've grappled with a long time here at Reason, which is young tech people are not our allies. We want them to be, many of them are, but they are not as a class quite as libertarian as you might think and hope. And this is the kind of thing that surprisingly uniformly, both in California and in Seattle, that this sort of, well, we are fortunate and wealthy. We think a certain amount of redistribution, a much higher amount of redistribution even than we might currently have, is appropriate. If the way we redistribute is a head tax on employment, so be it. I think that's a pretty common view. So I don't have faith in the young tech people, as you call them, to save us. This is the place where I always struggle with my, you know, there's a certain type of person in our world who is like, if we just had a consumption tax, then all our problems would be solved. And I'm really sympathetic to that. Like, I think maybe if we just had a consumption tax, all our problems really would be solved. We're never going to have a consumption tax. So that's why I don't spend a lot of time on that issue, really, or we're never going to move all the way there. But, you know, the general case against income taxes is like, don't tax work. Work is what we want people to do more of. Don't tax it. And this is like even more specifically, like, don't tax employing an additional human who was previously not employed to do work. Like, don't tax it. If you want more of it, don't tax it. And it seems so obvious, and it's unclear to me why it's so hard for city governments or state governments to embrace that idea.
Well, it's going
to
be great when Amazon opens their second headquarters here in Washington, D.C.
Yes.
And the D.C. economy, just as a side note, I live in Washington, D.C.
And own a home here.
And I own a home here. And I'm very excited about the effect of pushing Amazon out of Seattle and into Washington. I'm not actually.
Yeah, well, you're worried because they're going to become more and more rent seeking, and it's going to raise your taxes.
I'm obviously worried about these sorts of political effects. By the way, I have to full disclose: my wife works for the Washington Post, which is owned by Jeff Bezos, who also owns Amazon. And I'm worried about some of these, some of the effects here.
That's a triple brag too, because he's saying he's married. This guy ain't an incel, His wife works for the Washington Post, and he's a homeowner, and he rides at bike lanes.
Wow.
While drinking,
we're not worthy.
From a flagon.
On the bike lane.
Never mead.
Yeah. I mean, I think the trouble is you should not rely, like, Amazon should not rely on Washington, D.C. to not immediately duplicate all of the mistakes that Seattle is making. Like, we will do it times a million. Just try us, mofos.
So I think this is a place, though, where, you know, it's up to us, the libertarian future, to explain to people why this is fucking stupid. And it's like, if Seattle wants to help the homeless, and if Seattle wants to have a certain quality of life, there are ways they can do that. And, I don't have to pay for Seattle. I don't have to live there, et cetera. If they want to pursue policies that I find stupid or negative to quality of life, you know, that's up to them. But I do think that it's worth, really not just being like, what a bunch of socialist idiots. It's like laying out what the problem is. And like, this is.
But that's what I'm saying people, right? It's like they're not a bunch of socialist idiots, but they do have a very high tolerance for redistribution. And they have, by and large, not invested a ton of thought into how to minimize the negative externalities and consequences of that. And I think it's good for us to highlight those and to point them out. But I also think in the end, like, that's not going to win the fight.
Right.
Like, I mean, you're redistributing wrong.
The tech worldview is also one that really kind of assumes that clever people with a fiddly little scheme can solve a problem.
A great algorithm.
Often, as all of the apps on my phone illustrate, often this is true, but they frequently kind of don't make a distinction between public and private attempts to do those things. And sometimes they just show up
in the public sector, right, and try to help.
Right.
Which is always a great harsh awakening.
Do you think that people, maybe not Seattle, because this is also, you know, that has like a far left tradition, like an anarchist tradition, a syndicalist tradition, all of this stuff going back, you know, decades, if not more than a century. And so does Portland, and so does San Francisco, et cetera. But like, if you say, okay, well, let's say you're interested in redistributing some income or money to people who are poor or people who can't afford housing, et cetera. Let's talk about, if we as libertarians say, okay, let's say that's your goal. Here are better ways to do it, because like, if you want, and we've seen this in a bunch of cities where it's like, you care about cheap housing or affordable housing for people, the best thing you can do, and we can show like cities that have done this, is build more housing, and surprisingly housing prices and rental prices come down, as opposed to all of the places.
It's not a coincidence that there's like a YIMBY movement in San Francisco. Yeah. Right? There's like a yes in my backyard movement where people are saying like, hey, maybe we can
this is where so many, I think, and just to Shanghai it into a discussion of the way libertarians talk about stuff, they will focus on, or a lot of libertarians will say, you know, these people are socialist idiots, and the idea that they want to redistribute any income or have any kind of social safety net shows that they're socialists, and we can't even convince them or talk to them. And it becomes this kind of culture war posturing instead of saying, like, look, you know, I mean, because I'm a libertarian, I'm not an anarchist. I believe in minimal government and I believe in a social safety net. And it's like, if you want to help poor people get a better education, the best thing is not to plow massive amounts of money into a centralized school district office that'll then fuck it up. It's just to give school choice, like either in terms of charters or vouchers, to poor people. If poor people are poor, give them money. Don't like make them have to go here, there, and everywhere for a housing voucher and for food vouchers. And I mean, I think this is
it's harder
the world,
to implement.
It's just teachable moments, Matt, all the way down.
It's harder to implement many of those policies at the city level, though. And I mean, really, it would be very difficult to say a guaranteed income for a city.
I'm not talking about a guaranteed income, but just
we'll bring on special guest star Jesse Walker.
But housing policy is
mostly set at the local level. Yes. And it's like, yeah. You know?
Housing is basically for the left what free trade is for the right. And it's an area where, in fact, the kind of liberal intelligentsia thinks we should have fewer housing. It tends to think we should have fewer housing regulations. And like,
are you just using Matt Iglesias as the liberal intelligentsia?
He's a good weather vane on that topic, I think.
I'm not just using Matt Iglesias.
Shut up.
I'm being now forced to convert my sentences into Rudy Giuliani sentences.
Rudy Giuliani, by the way, going to be the next Pepperidge Farm spokesman, I'm pretty sure.
I love goldfish.
About a year and a half ago, the California Little Hoover Commission, which is their best kind of like gold star, let's get our eggheads together and think about stuff and produce 1,000-page reports that actually have a lot of really good.
Little Hoover, by the way, also a great up-and-coming SoundCloud rapper. Just want you to know that.
Yes, Little Hoover. It's a reference to J. Edgar, not to Herbert. Anyways, they came up with this really damning report that I recommend people go look, and you can see find it through an LA Times column that I wrote about a year and a half ago and linked over at Reason, in which it spelled out in incredibly painstaking detail. It was all about affordable housing and the problems of it in California. And the conclusion was, hey, listen, all these efforts in cities like Santa Monica and Los Angeles and coastal cities for the most part, these efforts to have the city build or mandate affordable housing even if all that stuff got built and even if the cost was worth it, it's just an absolute drop in the bucket to the overall problem. It is, and I don't have the numbers in front of me, like it's 6,000 units in a place where we need, you know, 350,000 units. And far and away, the biggest aspect, the biggest thing that's affecting the rising price of rent and housing in these places are the regulations affecting builders and increasing costs and time to build new stuff. So your regulations, and many times they make this the same thing. Like, oh, you're going to build a new thing? Great. Well, here's a bunch of regulations on top of it in the name of affordable housing, which makes it less likely that people want to build in the first place. So the most respected kind of source of this drops a huge, really convincing report. Nobody talked about it. Like, there's 1,000 articles about the homeless problem in Southern California, which, after having been there a couple of times recently, it's just shocking to look at physically. Like, my God, what is happening everywhere? And no one talked about it. I wrote a column about this, and, you know, in the Nick Gillespie spirit of, hey, teachable moment, here we can go, without doing a lot of name calling and this kind of stuff. And people were just like, oh, whatever, Koch brothers. Anyways, we really need to combat these greedhead developers because they're getting in the way of affordable housing. It is it's astonishing to me. And Bill de Blasio, he got elected to New York on the issue of affordable housing, and his way to do it is to punish developers. It doesn't make any sense at all. And we have a lot more persuading to do. And that's all the persuading we have time for, because we have to shift now into what the hell are we consuming out there, Nick?
I'm reading Jake Tapper, the CNN anchor, his novel, The Hellfire Club, which is set in 1950s in Washington, D.C. It is a real crackerjack.
All right, Catherine, what are you on?
I feel
right
like
now?
I can't top that. I did, in fact, actually read the new Zora Neale Hurston book that I was so stoked about in the last podcast. It delivers. I encourage all of you
does
to
it
get
smoke
a hold of
out
it.
Zora Neale Hurston with gusto?
It absolutely does. Like Matt Welsh to the teetering on the brink of his mortality.
See, not an S.
John McCain. It smokes out slavery with gusto. Yeah. No, it's extremely good. I highly recommend reading it and then immediately watching Westworld, because it will give you a lot of thoughts about how Westworld is really actually just about chattel slavery. The end.
Totally. Thank you. This is 2 weeks in a row, Catherine. You've rocked my world first by mentioning the
Zora Neale
Hurston.
It's just Zora Neale Hurston every time. It's not really me.
No, but it's also the Westworld, because I watched last night's episode and I'm kind of like, you know, all right. So first it's about big data, then it's about this. And
yeah, I think it maybe it's some combination of like chattel slavery and just like Mario Vargas Llosa's robot fever dream.
Suitor Pants?
I just finished reading Ian McEwan's novel Sweet Tooth from 2012. It's a sort of interesting bit of spy metafiction. I don't want to say too much, but
Sweet
it's weirdly.
Tooth.
Yeah. So it's about British MI5, MI6 spies in the sort of during the roughly around the Watergate era, although it takes place over a number of years, told by a woman who ends up getting recruited into the system and then, of course, has to start. Has to help recruit writers for a sort of cultural program. And so it gets into some of the kind of Encounter magazine stuff, you know, where this it's sort of the British parallel to the CIA's funding of kind of neoliberal left, you know, center left publications that were anti-communist.
And is she the Sweet Tooth?
Well, the program is called Sweet Tooth, and she ends up recruiting a novelist and then falling in love with him. And of course, he's not a novelist when they recruit him, because they can't afford to get somebody who's already done it, right? So they've got somebody who is maybe going to be a professor, but has written some good short stories. And they're like, we'll give you a stipend so that you don't have to be a professor. You can just write, and we want you to work on a novel. They, of course, mask where the funding is coming from, right? So it's all kind of routed through a foundation. I don't want to reveal the end, but it's this a kind of fascinating, quasi lightly, not quite autobiographical novel. The spy elements are sort of added in and made up, but
does
about
anyone
what it's
say
like to
that
be a young writer in the 1970s.
Does anybody
in the
say
UK.
It's, don't you see, it's just a game?
I think the novel would have been even better if that had been the kicker.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, whatever.
End,
well, again, without spoiling the
end. When I look back
edge,
on those days, I realized then as now, it's just a game.
But it's kind of ends up drawing a parallel between the job of a writer as or a novelist anyway, and the job of a spy, which is in some sense to see what the other to see through someone else's eyes and to end up getting to know them. And again, it's very clever and sort of very twisted and convoluted, not just in terms of its plot, but in terms of the way the narrative kind of folds inwards on itself at the end. It's also a delightfully written page turner that you could read in an evening.
Does it shed any light on Westworld though?
I mean, I think probably yes. I'm not going to say how.
I watched this weekend a very enjoyable documentary. I wouldn't say that it's like phenomenal, but it's very enjoyable, called Beside Bowie. It's about Mick Ronson, the great guitar player who was the one after, you know, Bowie had been trying a whole bunch of different personae and songs and none of it was really landing. Ronson shows up. And then we get Hunky Dory, Ziggy Stardust, and just kind of the run that made David Bowie who he was, and then was summarily dispatched after that, and his life kind of he never really got the accolades that he was due, and he certainly didn't get any production and kind of writing credit and royalties that he should have, although they don't dwell as deeply on that as they could have. For those of you who enjoy Lou Reed's Transformer record there, which I think is, by acclamations, is his best solo work, it's produced by David Bowie, but you come to the conclusion that it's basically Ronson who did the piano, he did the string arrangements. And he's just like this meathead gardener from Hull, from Northern England somewhere. And so it's just a great look at one of the better and more formative musicians who didn't get his due for a variety of reasons. And it's also kind of like a meditation on partnerships that are essential and both sides love it, but one has to sort of jettison the other to go to a different place. And it can be kind of heartbreaking in that sense. And that's all the heartbreak we have time for, Nick, here. Listen to this podcast over and over again to hear the grunts. If you listen to the grunts at that double speed, it's even better. Then go and subscribe at iTunes. Rate and review us. Reason Podcast happens all week long. Nick interviews interesting people. Catherine interviews interesting people. Other interesting people interview other interesting people. Any podcasts to tee up for this week, Nick, that are of a special importance?
Yeah, I know Catherine has one, but Jonathan Rauch, author of the great book Kindly Inquisitors, is back with a new tome called The Happiness Curve, Why Life Gets Better After 50. So for all you people who aren't 50, go fuck yourselves. And for those of us who are on the right side of 50, it's clear sailing. It's a really interesting conversation. Rauch is a spectacular writer and researcher and thinker, and it's we sometimes limit libertarianism to, you know, very political or policy oriented topics. If you take seriously the idea of like autonomy and living your life to the fullest and kind of living your life as a work of art, Ayn Rand kind of strayed into that territory, certainly along with people like Nietzsche and whatnot. This book, it's really, really worth reading no matter where you are on the happiness curve.
Awesome. Well, thanks for that. Stay tuned for that.
Catherine, though, and has a podcast coming out too, which I think is...
We're doing a lot of advertising this time. I am talking with Mary Catherine Hamm. Right. We are going to be talking about social media from the personal and political perspectives and the fact that we both have ovaries.
Awesome. I didn't know. All right. Thank you for listening. Stay tuned for us next Monday as well. And goodbye.